Within the next quarter hour, a stag party had taken over Holly Golightly's apartment. Several of them in uniform. I counted two naval officers and an Air Force colonel, but they were outnumbered by graying arrivals beyond draft status. Except for a lack of youth, the guests had no common theme. It was as if the hostess had distributed her invitations while zigzagging through various bars, which was probably the case. O.J. Berman avidly exploited the new company to avoid discussing my Hollywood future. I was left abandoned by the bookshelves. Of the books there, more than half were about horses, the rest baseball. Pretending an interest in horseflesh and how to tell it gave me sufficiently private opportunity for sizing Holly's friends. Presently, one of these became prominent. He was a middle-aged child that had never shed its baby fat, though some gifted tailor had almost succeeded in camouflaging his plump and spankable bottom. There wasn't a suspicion of bone in his body. His face, a zero filled with pretty miniature features, had an unused, a virginal quality. It was as if he'd been born, then expanded, his skin remaining unlined as a blown-up balloon. He was behaving as though the party were his, like an energetic octopus. He was shaking martinis, making introductions, manipulating the gramophone. In fairness, most of his activities were dictated by the hostess herself. "Rusty, would you mind? Rusty, would you please?" The man's name was Rutherford, Rusty, Trawler. In 1908, he'd lost both his parents, his father the victim of an anarchist and his mother of shock, which double misfortune had made Rusty an orphan, a millionaire, and a celebrity, all at the age of 5. He'd been a standby of the Sunday supplements ever since, a consequence that had gathered hurricane momentum when, still a schoolboy, he had caused his godfather custodian to be arrested on charges of sodomy. After that, marriage and divorce sustained his place in the tabloid sun. His first wife had taken herself and her alimony to a rival of Father Divine's. The second wife seems unaccounted for, but the third had sued him in New York State, with a full satchel of the kind of testimony that entails. He himself divorced the last Mrs. Trawler, his principal complaint stating that she'd started a mutiny aboard his yacht. Though he'd been a bachelor since, apparently before the war, he'd proposed to Unity Mitford. At least, he was supposed to have sent her a cable offering to marry her if Hitler didn't. This was said to be the reason Winchell always referred to him as a Nazi. That, and the fact that he attended rallies in Yorkville. I was not told these things. I read them in the Baseball Guide, another selection off Holly's shelf which she seemed to use for a scrapbook. Tucked between the pages were Sunday features, together with scissored snippings from gossip columns. Holly came up from behind and caught me reading Miss Holiday Golightly of the Boston Golightlys, making every day a holiday for the 24-carat rusty trawler. "And how are you making out with O.J.?" she said, adjusting her dark glasses as she glanced over my shoulder. "We've separated by mutual agreement." "He's an opportunity, believe me. He really can help you."
"I understand you weren't too appreciative."
She seemed puzzled until I said,
"The story of Dr. Wassel?"
"He's still harping," she said, and cast across the room an affectionate look at Berman. "But he's got a point. I should feel guilty. I knew damn well I'd never be a movie star. It's too hard, and if you're intelligent, it's too embarrassing. My complexes aren't inferior enough. Being a movie star and having a big fat ego are supposed to go hand in hand. Actually, it's essential not to have an ego at all. I don't mean I'd mind being rich and famous. That's very much on my schedule. But if it happens, I'd like to have my ego tagging along. I want still to be me when I wake up one fine morning and have breakfast at Tiffany's. You need a glass," she said, noticing my empty hands. "Rusty, will you bring my friend a drink?" She was carrying her cat in one hand. "Poor slob," she said, tickling his head.
Poor slob without a name. It's a little inconvenient, but I haven't any right to give him one. He'll have to wait until he belongs to somebody. We just sort of took up by the river one day. We don't belong to each other. I don't want to own anything until I know I've found the place where me and things belong together. I'm not quite sure where that is just yet, but I know what it's like. It's like Tiffany's. Not that I give a hoot about jewelry. That's not why I'm mad about Tiffany's. Listen, you know those days when you've got the mean reds?
Same as the blues?
No. The blues are because you're getting fat, or maybe it's been raining too long. You're sad, that's all. But the mean reds are horrible. You're afraid and you sweat like hell, but you don't know what you're afraid of, except that something bad is going to happen. Only you don't know what it is. You've had that feeling?
Quite often. Some people call it angst.
All right, angst. But what do you do about it?
Well, a drink helps.
I've tried that. I've tried aspirin, too. What I've found does the most good is just to get into a taxi and go to Tiffany's. It calms me down right away. Nothing very bad could happen to you there. Not with those kind men in their nice suits and that lovely smell of silver and alligator wallets. If I could find a real-life place that made me feel like Tiffany's, then I'd buy some furniture and give the cat a name. I've thought maybe after the war, Fred and I...
She pushed up her dark glasses, and her eyes had taken on a far-seeing sharpness.
I went to Mexico once. It's a wonderful country for raising horses. I saw one place near the sea. Fred's good with horses.
Rusty Trawler came, carrying a martini. He handed it over without looking at me.
I'm hungry,
he announced.
It's 7:30, and I'm hungry. Let's go.
I want you to behave, Rusty.
She spoke softly, but there was a governess threat of punishment in her tone that caused an odd flush of pleasure, of gratitude, to pink his face.
You don't love me,
he complained, as though they were alone.
Do you love me?
She patted him.
Tend to your chores, Rusty, and when I'm ready, we'll go eat wherever you want.
As he returned to his duties with a satisfied waddle, I couldn't resist reminding her that she hadn't answered his question. Do you love him?
I told you, you can make yourself love anybody. Besides, he had a stinking childhood.
If it was so stinking, why does he cling to it?
Use your head. Can't you see? It's just that Rusty feels safer in diapers than he would in a skirt, which is really the choice, only he's awfully touchy about it. Oh, by the way, I'm not pretending I don't know he's rich. Even land in Mexico costs something.
She reached for my martini. I hadn't touched it. She drained it in two swallows.
Now, she said, quit stalling. You're going to make friends with O.J.
An occurrence at the door intervened. It was a young woman, and she entered like a windrush, a squall of scarves and jangling gold. Holly, she said, wagging a finger as she advanced. You miserable hoarder, hogging all those simply riveting men. She was well over 6 feet, taller than most men there. They straightened their spines, sucked in their stomachs. There was a general contest to match her swaying height.
Holly said, what are you doing here?
And her lips were taut as a drawn string.
Why, nothing, sugar. I've been upstairs working with Mr. Yuniashi. Christmas stuff for the bazaar. But you sound vexed, sugar.
She scattered a roundabout smile.
You bell is not vexed at me for buttoning on your party.
Rusty Trawler tittered. He squeezed her arm as though to admire her muscle and asked her if she could use a drink.
I surely could. Holly, honey, she said, slightly shoving her, don't you bother about me. I can introduce myself.
She stooped toward O.J. Berman, who, like many short men in the presence of tall women, had an aspiring mist in his eye.
I'm Mag Wildwood, from Wildwood, Arkansas. That's hill country.
She was a triumph over ugliness, so often more beguiling than real beauty, if only because it contains paradox. In this case, even the stutter had been turned to advantage. It was the master stroke, that stutter, for it contrived to make her banalities sound somehow original. And secondly, despite her tallness, her assurance, it served to inspire in male listeners a protective feeling. To illustrate, Berman had to be pounded on the back because she said,
"Who can tell me where is the John?
Then he offered her an arm to guide her himself. "That," said Holly, "won't be necessary. She's been here before. She knows where it is." After Mag Wildwood had left the room, she said, sighed, rather, "It's really very sad." She paused long enough to calculate the number of inquiring expressions. It was sufficient.
"And so mysterious. You'd think it would show more. But heaven knows, she looks healthy. So, well, clean. That's the extraordinary part. Wouldn't you," she asked with concern, but of no one in particular, "wouldn't you say she looked clean?"
Mag Wildwood couldn't understand it, the abrupt absence of warmth on her return. The conversation she began behaved like green logs. They fumed but would not fire. More unforgivably, people were leaving without taking her telephone number. The Air Force colonel decamped while her back was turned, and this was the straw too much. He'd asked her to dinner. Suddenly, she was blind. She took it out on everyone. She called her hostess a Hollywood degenerate. She invited a man in his 50s to fight. She told Berman Hitler was right. She exhilarated Rusty Trawler by stiff-arming him into a corner.
"You know what's going to happen to you," she said with no hint of a stutter. "I'm going to march you over to the zoo and feed you to the yak."
He looked altogether willing, but she disappointed him by sliding to the floor where she sat, humming. "You're a bore. Get up from there," Holly said, stretching on a pair of gloves. The remnants of the party were waiting at the door, and when the bore didn't budge, Holly cast me an apologetic glance.
"Be an angel, will you, Fred? Put her in a taxi. She lives at the Winslow."
They were gone. The prospect of steering an Amazon into a taxi obliterated whatever resentment I felt. But she solved the problem herself. Rising on her own steam, she said,
"Let's go, Stork. Catch Lucky Balloon."
And fell full length like an axed oak. My first thought was to run for a doctor, but examination proved her pulse fine and her breathing regular. She was simply asleep. After finding a pillow for her head, I left her to enjoy it.